From Flourish DX, this is the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. With workplace mental health becoming a safety prerogative, this is the source of information on psychological injury prevention and health promotion.
Hi, and welcome to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. My name is Jason Van Shee, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. The aim of the podcast is to rapidly increase the knowledge and application of psychological health and safety in workplaces worldwide. To help with this, we have regular guests from around the world who are leading the way in this important area. But before I introduce our guest and topic for today, allow me to introduce my co-host, Joelle Mitchell. How are you today, Joelle?
Well, the good news is that my air conditioning got fixed yesterday.
Yay.
So I last night enjoyed my first night of uninterrupted sleep for probably 2 weeks.
Yep.
So that was nice. The downside of that is that I obviously still have quite a bit of sleep debt to recover from. So I started this morning feeling pretty good, but I'm starting to fade already. So,
well, you got a big
I've had a big cup of coffee. That's my second coffee for the day. So that's about the limit for me. So we'll just have to struggle along and do the best. I'll do the best that I can.
Yeah. Well, look, that will be good enough today. I think our guest today is going to carry us.
I think so as well.
Yeah. So yeah. We'll be fine.
We will be fine.
Awesome. Well, on that, I should probably introduce him in.
Yes.
Okay. So he's an endorsed psychologist with over 17 years experience across corporate, sport, defense, clinical, government, and academic sectors. His doctorate involved exploring psychosocial factors that lead to the enhancement of human functioning and developing strategies for the enhancement and maintenance of performance with the West Coast Eagles. He currently is the CEO and co-founder of Mental Health. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. David Anthony.
Thank you, Jace, Joelle. It's great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on, mate. Really looking forward to today's topic. We have had, you know, people like Don McCreary on previously looking at some of these issues through a gendered lens, but, you know, you have a really great understanding, particularly of the men's perspective as well. So really looking forward to the topic today.
Yeah, great. And look, anything I can do to help carry you two along after a big week, I'll see how the shoulders go.
Yeah, no pressure, mate.
So, Dave, before we get started with the serious questions, we like to ask our guests what podcasts they enjoy.
Yeah, right. So a couple of my faves. The first is Ain't That Swell, which is a surfing podcast. It probably shows one of my primary interests as well as a surfer. The other one that probably gets a fair bit of time is 10% Happier as well. So they're my two most listened to's, and then there's a couple of others in there as well that I like to use to escape or listen to on long drives as well.
Nice. Surfing, not something that I know anything about.
Well, it's kind of in the sports arena, right?
It is, so, yeah.
How's your bike riding to work going on that? Just for an update for our listeners.
Listeners, I would suggest that a Perth summer is not the time to commence trying to ride your bike to work. So
even on an electric bike that does the work for you?
Well, it doesn't though. You still have to pedal. It's not a low powered motorbike. It's not how it works.
So Joel, do you live upwind or downwind of the office the assistance of the doctor?
It's north to south, so it's not.
Yeah,
you know, the doctor comes from the west.
Yeah, it would just be. Yeah, there will be headwind in the afternoons. Yeah,
and Joelle weighs literally nothing, so any breath of wind would probably knock her over.
Basically, that's the problem for me. Yeah.
Yeah. But we're still, so listeners, just if you have been listening for the last few months, we are still waiting for Joelle to turn up in her Lycra one of these days. So
I think you should just stop talking about my Lycra, Jason. It's a bit creepy.
Okay.
Dave, tell us about your professional career.
Yeah, right. So where to start? It's a funny world, a funny journey, but I started my working career as a structural drafts person, so drawing structural steel for a living. Funnily enough, I was exposed to the Rotary Youth Leadership Awards as a part of that job that I had through my boss, and that's where I got introduced to psychology. A couple of psychologists that were working the program, I was stuck around. It was a week-long leadership and personal development camp for 18 to 25-year-olds. And I went the first year as a participant and applied to be a part of the leadership team after that. And so I was involved in that for another 3 years and got to work pretty closely with a couple of psychologists that were advising the program. And that's where my interest in psychology came from. I couldn't have told you what it was prior to that. Never had any experience of it, being a kid that finished school in the mid-90s. And yeah, so from there, I went back to uni. I started a psychology degree. I did my undergrad and honours and started as an army psychologist and spent 6 years working around Australia and overseas full-time, supporting defence personnel doing what they do. Personally, professionally, a very rewarding experience and one that taught me a lot about the value of, you know, this notion of psychology for good and for performance, which is, you know, not always considered or front of mind, if you like, when you start to, you know, talk about psychology and mental health. So, yeah, from there, I jumped out of full-time service in 2011 and went back to do a Master of Sport and Exercise Psychology and then swore that was it, as I did after my undergrad. But I got an offer to do a PhD over West, so just up the road from y'all, and at UWA there. So I spent 3 years doing my PhD with University of Western Australia and West Coast Eagles, which was such a great opportunity, such a great learning experience. And from when I started my master's through to when I finished my PhD, I'd been doing some reserve work as an army psychologist. I'd been doing some corporate work and some workplace mental health consulting. You know, once the PhD was wrapped up, I jumped into a role with Communicorp, which was all about workplace mental health consultancy and working with organisations to help them progress towards a more psychologically safe and healthy workplace using a systemic approach. We got talking about, with myself and two co-founders of Mantle, probably about 2018, we got talking about, well, you know, I've had all this experience in male-oriented environments, male-dominated workplaces consisting mainly of men, whatever you want to call them. And our anecdotal experience didn't really line up with the way that we were educated as psychologists. And so we started looking at what the research told us about that and identified that, you know, there was empirical support for this notion of a gendered approach to psychology. And so after about almost 20 months of development, we kicked Mantle off, which is a one-on-one video telehealth psychology service primarily for men. It was pre-COVID, but we didn't get it out there at the start of COVID. We wanted to make sure it was right. You know, we're still developing and building that product after 16 months, but, you know, also having some great success for our the people that engage with our service. And that's where I invest most of my time as a psychologist now. So that's, you know, the 18 odd years of psychology practice that I've had. And, you know, I've been really fortunate in that I've worked across a range of environments that Jason mentioned earlier, but, you know, having clinical and forensic exposure through, you know, a couple of the university degrees, having, you know, this opportunity for performance environments, having, you know, worked across sort of a range of different workplaces, both public and private sector. I consider myself really fortunate to have had the experience I've had, and, you know, I really enjoy what I do and learning more about psychology every day.
Yeah, fantastic. Starting out as a draftsperson then moving into psychology, that's almost unprecedented, I would say. Gave you a good understanding of some of the stuff that we talk about, though, in terms of the you know, the relationship between work factors and mental health outcomes.
Yeah, look, I wasn't a great student at school. I nearly said kid, but I think I was okay as a kid. You know, the drafting side of things was opportunistic. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't have the marks to do anything worthwhile, really. And so mum saw it in a paper and said, why don't you apply for this? I went, yeah, right, hey. So that's how I got into drafting. But it was a, you know, it was a really great opportunity as a result of those other kind of programs I got exposed to at the behest of my boss. So, you know, credit to Vince Vaughan if he's out there listening. You know, he was the one that was responsible for me heading down the psychology path.
Not the Vince Vaughan of Hollywood, I'm assuming.
No, I wish. Bit of a man crash on.
I was going to say he is one of our regular listeners. That is. Vince Vaughan. Yeah, you're Vince Vaughan, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Hey, Vince.
Yeah. Vince, give us a call if you're listening in. Love to have a chat about some projects we got on the cards.
So, Dave, tell us a little bit more about why you decided to start Mantle with your co-founders.
Yeah. So it was, as I mentioned there, it was this notion that, you know, we look at the field of psychology and over 80% of the psychologists are female. That was 2018. I'm expecting it's probably still pretty similar in terms of gender split. But there was this sort of consistent feeling as a result of those different environments we worked, whether it's high performance, whether it's military, whether it's, you know, certain corporate environments, that the way that psychology is sort of badged and the way we're trained doesn't necessarily work when we start to look at those workplace factors, environmental factors, as opposed to just focusing on the individual. And we were really interested as to why the way that you would engage with men in those environments would would require something that wasn't really aligned with the theories and the practices that were sort of taught at uni. And so, you know, for us it was sort of, you know, this idea got bounced around a little bit. Well, what is a service that caters to a specific gender, like what does that actually look like? And funnily enough, you look at across other health environments or other health areas, and you know we prescribe to genders in certain ways. So why weren't we doing that in psychology? And so when we started looking at the research into it, there was a great sort of amount of research probably over the last decade that really identified that, you know, the way that we work with men, based primarily on, you know, what we see from an illness and suicide perspective, needs to be different. And so, you know, part of our remit is, you know, doing something about the male suicide rate in Australia and elsewhere when we get the chance to grow. But also, you know, this notion of improving the lives of men and those around them, which critically, you know, sure, we look at the service offering. It's about an individual focus, but at the same time, we also acknowledge that the environment in which you operate is critical. So that's where Mantle came from.
So for those who know Mantle or think they know Mantle, I think they would probably look at it in the same kind of vein as an employee assistance provider with a gendered lens, but I believe there's more to it, right? So how does the Mantle offering differ from traditionally what is known as EAP?
Yeah, great question. I'll keep it clean. So, you know, the way that Mantle differs, you know, there's a couple of factors. One is we try and move upstream from this notion of crisis-oriented support. We focus a lot on this notion of, and this is something, you know, we've got our vision about helping men be better partners, brothers, fathers, colleagues, leaders, and mates. And, you know, for us, there needs to be an aspirational focus on, you know, how are we building and maintaining our mental health as opposed to just responding to illness and ill health. And you know, when we look at the AAP alternative that we see Mantle positioned as, it's this notion that it's not just about crisis support or, you know, our sort of late secondary, tertiary sort of intervention. It's very much about, well, how do we move to a place where we're working with people when they have the capacity to make better change that protects them against illness and ill health longer term? So this notion of aspirational growth and development through You know, you might call it coaching. We talk about it as being performance coaching, as opposed to sort of executive coaching, because that's a little bit exclusive. But, you know, for us, it's about when we're engaging with people, noting that we will still support people that have been struggling for a period of time. But it's about not just the not so good to good service offering, but how do we do more with the good to great service offering? Because we know from a cognitive perspective, that's where we have the greatest opportunity to make lasting change that will be a protective factor when we experience periods of difficulty, which is an inevitable part of, being a human.
Yeah. So I know there are other EAP providers that, would say that they are operating in the preventative space, or, EAP is not just for those people who are, like you say, trying to get through a period of distress or what have you, but really how do you optimize well-being and performance as well? So how would you say Mantle differs to, I guess, what those EAPs are saying that they're providing?
Yeah, good question. So, for us, it's looking at, the people that we're using to deliver our services primarily. So, how do we ensure that when someone engages with us, with a mental psychologist, that they have the capacity to work on the areas that that enhance their performance longer term, as opposed to sort of a band-aid fix. We also talk about the opportunity to work with teams, workplaces, organizations to address some of those factors that may be causing distress. So, interestingly, I listened to a presentation yesterday put on by my superannuation company about resilience at a team-based level, and it was all about the individual. There was this focus on, well, these are the things you need to do to move through periods of distress or, fatigue, or, and, they bandied around this notion of burnout. But the reality is, if you're looking at a team-based approach, you need to support the individual, but you also need to support or make changes at the environmental level, whether that's a team, a workplace, an organisation. And for us, that's, our psychs are great clinicians, but they also have an inherent understanding of what is required at a workplace level to support this notion of, mental health in the workplace. And that's how we see ourselves as different. I would say more effective than what's been done in the past.
Yeah. And obviously we got you on for what, largely this reason, in that, you are on that, maybe the tertiary end in a lot of cases, but you're also on the performance end, but you're also looking at the shared responsibility, I guess, for workplace mental health and wellbeing, rather than purely, as you were saying, with that other provider who's talking about resilience, looking at it purely as an individual responsibility.
It was a bit unpleasant. Because, this was pitched as, team-based resilience, and there was nothing in there that was team-based. It was all about, well, what do I do if I'm having a period of difficulty? Which critically, sure, it might suit the definition of resilience, but we know resilience is more about, more than just the individual, it's more about the environment and maximising opportunities within the environment to enhance performance, to enhance mental health, to lessen the likelihood of longer-term injury and illness.
Yeah, and it's great that you mention as well the qualifications and experience that your psychologists have on your team. I have previously worked as on a consulting side of a company that also offered EAP, and often I saw it was just a race to the bottom in terms of price. And then when you do that, it's kind of like, well, we can't afford to employ psychologists at this rate, so let's just get the minimum viable kind of person in. And it's often a counselor or someone who's had minimum training in the space, compared to a psychologist who has obviously quite rigorous training and then ongoing professional development requirements as well. And then, as you say, there's another level of complexity as well, because it's not just about understanding the counseling environment, it's also then understanding the workplace factors. And then on top of that, you've added another layer of complexity, which is around the gendered lens, going, well, this is a service that's specifically for men, so we need to think about how we do this a bit differently compared to you know, offering a mixed gendered approach.
Yeah, really true. It's you know, being 16 months old, it's an interesting consideration. You know, this notion of, well, what do we do for workplaces that, and this might be a little bit controversial, but it's important we consider, you know, this notion that, you know, gender equality, gender and equity and diversity more broadly. Yeah, sure, there's some shifts that need to happen to make workplaces more inclusive. But at the same time, we don't want to go too much the other way. And one of the things that we identify as, you know, when we're adopting this gendered approach to psychological support is that, you know, one size doesn't fit all. And if we go back to that question about what makes us different from those traditional EAPs, is it's not a off-the-shelf offering. It's very much, well, what does your workplace need? How do we identify initially whether those needs are what is actually required? And how do we make sure that what we're offering meets the requirements of the workplace, both from a risk perspective, but also from a sort of a strengths-based approach where we're ensuring that it's not just about ill health and illness prevention, it's also about performance enhancement and health promotion.
Yeah, because that's at the end of the day quite preventative as well, right? You don't want to just be picking up the pieces. You want to be, you know, working with people to prevent them from having to use the support side of the service that you're offering.
Yeah. It's, and I mean, this is, I continue to get frustrated, and you know, I've really enjoyed listening to some of the podcasts that, or the episodes that you guys have put out, and like I continue to get frustrated at this concept confusion out there that simply around what is mental health and what is mental illness, and you know, the absence of one doesn't equal, you know, the presence of another. And you know, we could talk about all those other concept confusion examples out there, but at its core, you know, if we look at what mental health is, it's different to what mental illness is, and we need programs that actually address both, not thinking that it's this binary continuum where mental health's at one end and illness is at the other end, because that's not helpful for the people that experience periods of ill health. And it's also not helpful from a sort of a performance enhancement or a health promotion, you know, healthy workplace kind of approach either.
Absolutely.
So, look, EAP utilization, and particularly among men, is notoriously low, and we sort of see those stats. I mean, EAP utilization across the board is low, but then the contribution of men to those numbers is it lower still. Do you have thoughts about why that is the case for a typical EAP?
Look, there's a couple of anecdotal pieces of information that I have from those that have worked in the space for a period of time. My own experience, I guess, you know, it goes back to this notion of a service not being fit for user. And you know, the other really interesting thing, if we look at men generally, there's a stat: 43% of men regret asking for support because it didn't meet their expectations. Now, you know, for mine, yeah, one, we're a fickle bunch as blokes, but you know, if that also to me highlights that there's a requirement to change the kind of services that we offer for men, just as there's a requirement to change sort of the different health services that we offer for different groups. So, you know, if we look at why EAPs, why the utilization rate is low and why it's even lower among men, I think it's just because it doesn't meet the needs of the people that try to engage with them, plainly.
Yeah, so I guess the parallel to draw there is, you know, the emerging commentary about, you know, medicine and how well it actually works for women, and that, you know, there's a growing recognition that there's a need for that gendered lens, but you know, thinking about medicine from a woman's perspective or a woman's experience, where the majority of research and interventions and treatments are based on men and how they respond to treatment. So it's sort of almost the reverse in the area of psychology from what you're saying there.
Yeah, look, that's a great call out, Joel. I hadn't thought of it like that. You know, the parallels there or the similarities, but it's basically, yeah. It's this notion that when we're looking at where the majority of the research, where the majority of the testing, the application of psychology has been, it's been with the female population. And so this, you know, a very technical term, the rainbows and lollipops approach to psych support doesn't land well with most men. You know, the research tells us that we need stuff that is or approaches that are about behavioral activation. We need approaches that are about maximizing strengths, that are about in ensuring there's a perception of autonomy with the way that treatment's going or therapy's going. You know, those three main areas I think are a critical consideration around, you know, or a critical challenge to the way psychology is traditionally perceived as sort of, you know, just having a chat. That doesn't work.
Mm. So are there steps that organisations can take to improve EAP utilisation among their male employees?
Yeah. I would encourage them to one, look at their data. If they don't have the data that tells them, what the gender breakdown of individuals using the EAP is, then ask for it. And if that can't be provided, I'd be looking at changing EAPs. The other thing that I'd encourage people to or organisations to look at is, well, do we really understand what the needs of our male employees are? Have we done the research, or are we just basing this on perception or what we've been told by others or what we might have been told by our EAP service, prior to them winning the contract as to why they're engaging? And if they're not engaging, then that tells me that something's not working. So again, let's look at asking the questions to identify what's missing, what our employees, male and female, don't like about the AP, and start to look at how we move the needle away from this notion of it just being about crisis support or critical incident response, and more about how we actually enhance mental health and improve performance.
Yeah, so sounds like what you're talking there is better screening of their choice of service providers in the first instance, to ensure that they're able to provide that sort of range of care for different groups and their needs. Then also, yeah, thinking about how you're actually promoting that service internally within the organization, because people do tend to think about EAP as, I'm in crisis and that's when I access it, rather than, I want to improve in an area or something like that. I can remember having conversations with colleagues where, they're talking about, difficulties with their parents and their relationship with their parents or something like that. And I would suggest, well, maybe you could actually go and talk with the EAP about that. And they'd say, oh, I'd never actually thought of that. That's a good idea. So, there's all of these different areas of your life where that, accessing that EAP service as an employee benefit can actually be of real value and help you with those stresses in your life. You don't have to be at a point where you're in crisis before you actually use that benefit.
Yeah, it's a great call out. The thing that I that sort of sticks with me about some of those comments there is when we look at the promotion of EAPs, traditional promotion, it's not working. And this is something that we really try and, again, look at, well, what's appropriate for the workplace that we might be supporting, and or the people in the workplace that we might be supporting. And, if an EAP is saying, well, we'll do these, we'll throw in a couple of seminars every 6 months for promotion. If that's not working, then the EAP service should be accountable for that. And they should be able to give you additional information or give you additional data that tells you why, you know, more about the people using the service and potentially why their service isn't working. You know, we see a lot of organizations paying inordinate amounts of money for an EAP program that has a utilization rate of, you know, 2%, you know, some less than that. And, you know, for mine, that's not value for money. You know, what are the other ways that we can increase people's mental health and well-being by providing services that are actually effective and wanted by the organisation, as opposed to just sort of continuing down this path that hasn't worked, which is, oh, we'll just run seminars every 6 months. You know, we'll whack up a couple of brochures around the office. We'll put it on the intranet. That hasn't worked for God knows how long, 10 years more, you know, as long as EAPs have been around. So, you know, to me, that means that that something in the system needs to change.
So if I was being cynical, which is very out of character for me.
Oh, it's completely off-brand.
I might suggest that it's a clever business model for an EAP to charge for a service that has a low utilization rate.
Oh, look. Is it about business or is it about improving people's experience at work? You know, is it about improving people's quality of life, noting that they spend the majority of the time at work? You know, it's incredibly frustrating that is the lens that's put on this. Yeah, sure, it might be ticking some boxes from a risk perception perspective. It's not effective. You know, there's other ways that this can be done. And I think the more that we can agitate for organisations to change the way that they do mental health, to change the way that they support their employees from a mental ill health and illness perspective, to change the work environment, to ensure that it gives the opportunity for the majority of the employees to for their work to be good for their mental health, then you know, that's the task in front of us as professionals in the space, right? Despite all the cynics.
Mm-hmm. So I think very much what I'm hearing is that it's about educating organizations about actually what they should be looking for in terms of getting value for the money that they're paying for their EAP.
Yeah. Why are we not more accountable? Why do we continue to see contracts renewed for EAP services that claim that they'll get a certain utilization rate and they don't even meet that utilization rate? You know, to me, there's something wrong with that system. So what do we do to change it? As organizations, we have a responsibility to use our money wisely to support our employees. And if there's no value for money in that, geez, I was trying to think of a different way to say that, but that'll do. You know, if there's no value in money or value of the money that we're spending on our EAP service, change it. Look at the other options. You know, is it really what you need, or is there other solutions out there that provide a better level of support, a better service, and a more effective tool for supporting employee mental health and workplace mental health than these approaches that we've relied on that haven't been successful?
Yeah, and we definitely see that EAP seems to be a default, or it seems to be like, we have to do something in the mental health space. What's everyone else doing? Well, EAP, let's do that. So it's surprising that, you know, companies would, try and tick the box for workplace mental health using something that is used by such a small percentage of their entire workforce, rather than looking at something that is, you know, maybe a primary prevention initiative that can be deployed across everyone and everyone can get benefit from. But, you know, that's the issues that we face as well. There's, you know, a lot of the primary prevention stuff is a lot less expensive than EAP, and a lot more employees can benefit from that than a low utilization service. But you mentioned before, Dave, that, you know, any EAP worth their salt would give their clients some good data about, you know, the kind of demographics of people who are utilizing the service, as well as some of the main issues that are coming up when people are seeking help. So how often would you say, or do you have any statistics on how often work factors would be the reason for people presenting?
I don't have any statistics for it. You guys might. But, you know, anecdotally, I would say that the majority of the time work is a secondary cause or a secondary stressor to, you know, whatever period of mental ill health or illness may be going on. Other times it's the primary. I think, you know, when we look at the challenges of the work environment, the changes in the way we've worked over the last couple of years, you know, sure, there's an increased perception of stress. There's an increased perception of challenge. There's this increased requirement to do more with less. But you know, what's the root cause? As a psychologist, one of the things that I love about psychology and that got me primarily interested in it was we're all different. And so, you know, whilst someone may present with this notion that, you know, what's happening at work is causing, you know, the deterioration of my relationships outside of work. Yeah, sure, there's a relationship there, but, you know, what's the primary cause? I'm not sure. We might have gone on a tangent there, Jason. Well, I might have gone off on a tangent to you.
No, I think that's very relevant. I mean, you know, I was asking for a simple answer, but it's not a simple question. Because you're right. It's usually there's one box to put in, like what's the primary reason for why this person is presenting at the EAP for support. And you wouldn't be able to say, well, the main issue is relationship difficulty. But what's causing that? Well, what is also contributing to that is the fact that this person's at work 14 hours a day, or doing night shifts permanently, or, you know, these sorts of things. So that's a contributing factor to the relationship breakdown. But the main reason that caused the person to reach out was, hey, my marriage is falling apart or something like that. So it'd be hard to capture that information, I'd imagine, but we definitely understand that, you know, they can relate to each other and they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, I mean, geez, it'd be great if they were mutually exclusive, right? It'd be much easier to kind of address. But
if only humans were less complex. I mean, the psychology would be so easy.
Yeah, it would be. I'd probably be working in a different field. But, you know, there's the analogy that always helps me think about this. And I realize that, you know, the pracademic in me, if you like, there's issues with the foundation of the, you know, the inverted U stress performance curve and, you know, our optimal zone of functioning, you know, where the Zirkz-Dodson theory came from, definitely not a law. But the thing that helps from a representational perspective is, you know, we only have one brain. And so, you know, if we have a level of stress as a result of our home environment, if we have a level of stress as a result of our work environment or the clash between the two, then our starting point to get into our optimal zone of performance, but also, you know, over into sort of overstress and distress and illness and injury and all those other things that come with that is much less. And so, you know, we it's really difficult to tease out what is the root cause a lot of the time when we don't have the right tools to identify exactly what's going on. And if we're just treating the you know, what the surface level issue is, then, you know, we may not actually be having a positive effect because, you know, it's not doing something to change the environment that's causing the stress.
Yeah, and I think this is a really important point because we do hear some managers try and cop out of their need to assist in, I guess, people's mental health because they'll say, oh, people come in with these issues. I can't help it that this person's relationship is falling apart, or I can't help it that this person just had a death in their family. I can't... you know, and then you think about macro factors that are outside of the control of the organization as well. I can't help it. There's a global pandemic. I can't help it that, you know, there's economic instability. You know, I can't help it. There's a war in Europe, you know, and there's supply chain issues. I can't help all of these things. And so they say, well, I can't do anything. Well, no, you can still make sure that you're attending to the work factors that are completely within your control. Because like you say, it's all cumulative. Stress we know is cumulative. It's not different sections of your life. you know, all the stress kind of builds up all together. So it's definitely shouldn't be a cop-out. We should be thinking about, well, what is in our control as an employer, and what how can we adjust to make sure that this person is able to maintain good mental health?
Yeah, so true. You know, this we hear it all too often, and you know, I'm a bit of a glass half full kind of guy, and you know, this approach that, well, you know, it's out of my control. Well, that's a load of rubbish, because ultimately, if that aspect, you know, whether it's supply chain issues, whether it's what's going on overseas, whether it's some pesky little virus that's hung around a bit too long, whether it's, you know, some other workplace factor that you might not have much control over, there's stuff that you can do that will make a difference. And understanding the factors that play into someone's mental health, that those protective factors outside of what may be causing illness or ill health, you know, having a better understanding of that allows you to be a much better leader. It gives you the capacity and the capability to be able to engage with your employees at an individual level, not at a team level, but at an individual level, because that's where the true difference is made. One size does not fit all. And when we think about this from, whether it's talking about EAPs more broadly, whether it's talking about individual members of my immediate team in the workplace, whether we talk about it from a social perspective, you know, to Joelle's point earlier about the way that the medical system treats individuals, it's all different. One size does not fit all. And when we can find out, or when we have the skills and capability as leaders, as colleagues, you know, even as family members outside of that, to ask the questions that help us understand the individual, or at least empathize and support them, then we have a much greater capacity to protect the mental health of individuals in the workplace.
Yeah, no, well said. So when we think about when someone does present to EAP for support, understanding that it's not always the primary reason or the initial reason they reach out for support, what are some of the main workplace issues or psychosocial factors, I guess, that are identified? And again, I understand you might not have, you know, statistics on this, but anecdotally, yeah. What are some of the things that you've noticed?
Yeah, look, anecdotally, I think, you know, there's this, I'm going to say this, and I've heard it multiple times, so, you know, it's not rocket surgery. Pun intended. So, you know, this notion that, you know, a lack of certainty is probably one of the primary presenting factors currently. It's, you know, this notion that we have limited opportunity to control the number of things that are going on in our lives, in our work lives at the moment. And so, you know, the lack of clarity around what that means for me as an employee, as an employer, as a leader, as a manager, as a colleague, makes it, you know, makes it difficult for me to know where I stand and how I do my best work. And so if we're talking about that from a, you know, a workplace factors perspective, we start to look at job demands, you know, we start to look at you know, supportive leadership, which isn't just for leaders, as we know, it's at all levels of the organisation. You know, these things, you know, the flip side of those are probably the primary presenting factors that we see. So it's focusing on the things that I can't do anything about, or that my leader can't do anything about. You know, that's what's driving me into, you know, seeking out additional support, you know, causing my stress and distress.
Yeah, that whole uncertainty is a big one, right? Particularly in the current VUCA world that we live in. I did pick up on something that someone wrote recently, and I've incorporated it into what I do as a leader as well. Because so much around uncertainty or worrying about what if, or what did that piece of communication mean from my leader or my manager or whatever, that can just increase people's already peaked anxiety given what's going on in the world at the moment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it could be very easy just to shoot an email to someone, say, hey, can we meet first thing tomorrow morning or something like that? And then people then would spend the night thinking, oh, what does my manager want to meet with me about? Have I done something wrong? That sort of thing. So what I've done is just, you know, taken an extra few seconds to say, oh, it's regarding this project, or yeah. you know, just a little bit of clarity, going, no, it's perfectly normal. Just want to have a catch up, get an update where we're at, you know, that sort of thing. But just, yeah, I think organizations kind of learn a lot regarding, you know, change management initiatives and anything where there is this uncertainty. Just a little bit of extra communication can actually help, you know, reduce people's stress levels or anxiety levels about certain things.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And it's quite easy. Mm. You know, it's taking a step back to go, well, actually, if I spend 30 seconds, a minute longer, taking the time to provide some additional context, that's going to, or that has the opportunity to result in less uncertainty at the other end. And the random digression here, there was some research that was done with medical professionals around this notion of empathy, one of the 10% happier podcasts that I listened to. And it was, you know, there was this belief that doctors' capacity to be empathetic with patients was, you know, they didn't have the time for it in the current environment. But when they broke down what does empathy actually look like, how long does a little bit of empathy take? And that's not the technical term, but that's the term I use. It was 30 seconds to a minute. And I'm not saying that we need to apply that in a leadership perspective, because it requires more. But, you know, from a reference point, it's not as complicated as people seem to think it is. And, you know, back to this point about leaders not being able to control or feeling like they can't do anything. It's, well, have a look at how you're communicating with your team. Have a look at how you're communicating with your colleagues, and what are the ways that you can change that a little bit to be a little bit more human? Because that's something that we all have the capacity to do, some more than others. But it's also a skill that we can develop with practice.
Yeah, and to put another kind of analogy in there, I remember I spent 5 years working at a liquor store to see me through uni. And I found, you know, even though if you felt like you're grumpy or, you know, you're tired or whatever, if you at least fake that you're happy and, you know, happy, like you want to serve a customer, it just prevented so many more issues that you might have with customers or customers getting angry or whatever. So just a little, like, few seconds that it takes to smile or say how are you, or you know, something like that, rather than just going about your job in a grumpy fashion. You know, it takes a tiny little bit of extra effort, but it resolves so many issues that you might have potentially as well. So yeah, it's these little things, right? The 10% happier is such a great name for that podcast, right? Because there's these little things that you can do that don't take a lot of time.
Yeah,
but just being human and understanding the person on the other side of the interaction is also human, you know, and how you know what you can do to kind of improve that interaction, yeah, has such a great benefit.
Yeah, you know, I'm interested in Giles' perspective here. Has the human approach come from Jason? Has it changed?
Jason doesn't often send me emails asking if we can meet. So
yeah, I try and avoid that where possible. Yeah. I'm thinking more about the juniors.
Yeah, the junior guys are yeah. Yeah, that's I know that my position is secure here, so I don't have really issues of uncertainty.
Yeah, it's very hard to find a replacement. I've looked.
yeah, do more with less.
Yeah, so no, Joelle is okay. but I'm interested, Dave, back on topic, is when thinking about the work-related factors that might present in a EAP type conversation, are there any differences that might be observed between men and female?
It's hard from the data that we have to draw to draw causation, I suppose, or to call out the differences. The thing that we see more frequently with men is they're presenting with stress, frustration, anger, interpersonal difficulties, maybe even a little bit of substance abuse. Is that inherently different to the way that, that females present. I'm not sure. So, you know, for mine, if we look at the way that we've learned as, and I'm talking we as in men, have learned, you know, our capacity to effectively express what's going on for us in an emotional in emotional language is not as well developed because we didn't have those opportunities or those role models when we were younger, you know, compared to women. And so, you know, if we look at the initial information gathering, you know, I would say it's a lot less clear with men. Because there's less insight currently, but you know, when you start to drill into it a little bit more, and you start to look at sort of subsequent presentations, that's where we see the change. And so, again, a really long answer to your question, but for me, it's you know, still too early to tell.
Yeah, and look, it may be if there are any differences, which I suspect there may be. I think maybe the reason for that difference might be the types of jobs that people are doing based on gender. So we know, for example, teaching is a profession that is more dominated by females than males, particularly in primary schools. We know that in healthcare, you know, nursing is much more female orientated than male oriented, or, you know, dominated, I should say. And we know that emotional demands dealing with people, you know, any job that has a lot of people interaction does increase emotional demands. So it would you'd expect that teachers and nurses would have more emotional demands than men if men aren't doing roles that require so much people interaction. So is that a gender issue or is that a job issue? You know, so it's it'd be an interesting one, and I think it's it might be a simple question, but probably a complex answer.
Yeah, it's the more that I think about it, it's you know, the challenge with psychology is sometimes, you know, the reliance on self-report, you know, if we compare a EAP service working with primarily with you know, an education population or a teaching population, you know, is that a fair comparison when we compare it with a mining environment? You know, is it a fair comparison when we look at kind of a trade environment where we're talking about building and construction to, you know, to a health services environment? I mean, it's a great opportunity for research, but how do we, is it really like for like? I haven't thought enough about it, but, you know, just in talking about it with you guys, I think, you know, it's an area for greater exploration, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, we're obviously collecting a fair bit of data through FlourishDX, and yeah, look forward to some of those, hopefully shedding a light on some of those issues in the future.
Yeah, I'll look forward to seeing it as well.
So, in terms of the, I guess, the reasons that people present to EAP, and then, you know, how well the EAP is able to uncover the more of the root causes, and, you know, obviously that's related to the issue of limited sessions. If you've only got three sessions, there's only, you know, how effective can you actually be? But that's a whole different tangent. So what I'm wondering about is reporting back to the employer. In terms of that data around, you know, sort of the reasons for presentation or some of the themes that are underpinning that, how well is that reporting done?
Poorly. I would argue that even when there's additional information requested or required, the disconnect between what is useful or usable data that actually paints a picture for what's going on in the workplace versus, you know, what are the options for EAPs to provide from the data that they have, there's a missing gap there. So what are the ways, if we're looking at a solution, what are the ways that we have a system where There's a connection between reporting in the workplace, again, some of the factors that may be coming up, that both promote mental health, but also, you know, increase risk of illness and injury. And how does that relate through the one reporting system to the presentations in an EAP? And that's not something that I think can be easily addressed, because we still have these workplaces or these organisations where there's a whole lot of different providers across the health and safety scope that aren't talking to each other, or isn't an opportunity to link that information together. And I'm not talking about a platform that, you know, an employee can go to and identify which services might be best suited to them as a result of their presenting problem or what's going on for them. But it's more about, how do we ensure that the system of reporting, both from a performance enhancement perspective, but also from an illness perspective, is connected. And I don't know if I don't know of an organisation that's doing that well currently, because of the way that we've sort of ramped up in mental health and workplace health and safety from a mental health perspective has always been piecemeal. To use one of Don McCreary's statements, there's a lot of snake oil salesmen out there, or salespersons out there. So, this notion that what does an EAP provide us with in terms of data? Nothing usable at this stage. Will that change? Yes, but there needs to be a system based approach that factors in the lead factors within an organisation, that factors in measurement of what's going on in the workplace, and how does that compare to what's being reported in the EAP level.
So you'd be looking at things like, sort of something that's pulling HR data, that's pulling data from sort of health and safety reports as well as investigations, probably, return to work data as well, and what's coming back from like your sort of occupational health provider in that rehab capacity, and actually pulling all of that together in some sort of a sensible way, as well as the EAP data, and then actually having something useful coming out of that.
Yeah, I think, and the part you left out there, Joelle, is what's going on from a true mental health perspective. So from an autonomy mastery purpose perspective, what are these things? If we look at the World Health Organization definition of mental health, what are the things that are sustaining the organization? What are the strengths there that are the protective factors against some of these risks, against some of these health and safety issues that, we're a risk averse environment because that's where we've had the focus. But to me, that doesn't give a true indication or a true picture of the health of an organisation if we're just addressing the risks and we're just reporting on those, which is what the approach has been to date.
So, Dave, then in an ideal world, how would you like to see employers engage with their EAP partners better?
Well, For me, it's ensuring that that the EAP isn't separate to the one that's providing the consulting around workplace health and safety or psychological health and safety, I should say. To me, it's looking at who is ultimately responsible for the systems-based approach to psychological health and safety, that person being responsible for a range of initiatives that are all interdependent on each other. How do they make sure that the system that they've got in place, they're reviewing and refining the system to provide the best outcomes or the best services for the employees? So, what does an EAP need to be? I think it needs to be a service that is part of a broader ecosystem that is around, that is based on, mental health from a, flourishing perspective through to looking at poor mental health, as well as looking at, low mental illness and high mental illness if we look at Keyes's GOT diagram. So, for mine, it's the system linking the services together. And that EAP, that's performance enhancement, that's, our systems-based approach to managing risk. That's looking at our wellness services, noting that that's a critical part of maintaining good mental health.
Yeah, so it sounds a fair bit different to how companies are currently engaging with the EAP providers. So how far off do you think we are? Months, years, decades before we start to see this kind of relationship again?
Yeah. Glass half full, Dave, says I'd like to think it's a couple of years away, but there's still a lot of change that needs to occur. There's still a lot of accountability that needs to be included in the initiatives, if we can call them that are being utilized across organizations. The EAP services that are being provided, the training services around workplace mental health that are being provided, all those aspects, there's limited accountability for what's being delivered. So that needs to change first. And we also need to increase our understanding from a research perspective what actually works. Again, some of the guests that you've had on previously, Don McCreary is such a great proponent for a gendered approach to, mental health programs. But, his key concern is that there's a long way to go. And he's much smarter man than me, but I think, and he's saying it's quite a ways away. So, I'll leave him to predict exactly when it's going to occur.
Yeah, and there's obviously a lot of things that, professionals like and organisations like your own can do to advance that cause, right? I mean, if we just keep going on the trajectory we are and not changing the way we're doing, well, things probably never change, right? But, it's great that there's organisations like your own that are looking at, well, what does good look like and what do we need to learn and apply in order to do this better?
Yeah. Look, evidence-based versus evidence-informed, there's a lot of cool buzzwords out there, but, at the end of the day, it's the providers, the services that work in this space. Also, having the courage to identify that if something's not working, they're not going to keep selling it. If something is ineffective, they need to do something to change it, to identify what's not working and fix it. Just like we see in, traditional health and safety paradigms. That's our responsibility as professionals, ethically. If our services aren't working, and we need to identify what's not working and fix it, because otherwise we're not adhering to our ethical principles.
Yeah, I feel like kindred spirits, Dave, because I definitely see that. We're working in a different space, right, around the psychosocial risk management side, and if psychosocial risk assessments have been around for, a couple of decades at least, but companies aren't using them, well, there's clearly something wrong with the methodology, and we need to meet the market, where they're comfortable. And so, I think there's a lot of innovation required in that space, as in the EAP space, to make sure that we are, getting utilization levels up and preventing, distress and mental illness to begin with.
Yeah, and critically, being able to support people quickly and effectively if they do find themselves experiencing difficulty, because it really frustrates me when I hear people talk about the relationship or the parallels between a physical injury and a psychological injury. Yeah, sure, that's great, but we're still not doing it better. People are aware of it, but the behaviors associated with making change to protect people against illness and ill health and to enhance their mental health, they're not there yet. And, until we get that right at a workplace level, we're not going to be able to address these broader systems. So, look, there's a bit of work to do, but, I'll identify with the kindred spirits comment, Jason, and we can work on it together.
Sounds good.
So I guess to come full circle in a way, so, we've talked about low utilization rates for traditional EAP and, does that actually make sense for organizations to be spending what they're spending in that space, given what they're actually, you know, the service that they're getting out of that? So is there then sort of justification for organizations to expect the EAPs to be able to help them in those upstream efforts to actually prevent the organizational causes of psychological harm?
Potentially, but if the EAPs don't have the capability or the skill set to do it, then that's not the answer. And I think, Jason, one of the comments that you made earlier was because there's this what was the phrase that you used about sort of competing to the bottom, drop to the bottom or something? What was it?
Yeah, race to the bottom.
Race to the bottom. Thank you. Yeah. Because there's this race to the bottom in terms of costing and price. You know, what we're doing is we're creating an environment where EAPs can't offer the services that are needed to do this. So there needs to be a shift in how we utilize or how we view these support services. And I mean, a little bit controversial, but you know, I would say that an employee assistance program in its current form, or even some of the iterations that we've seen more recently, isn't effective. People aren't using the EAP more. They're not using the platforms that EAPs have established to enhance mental health more than you know, them being separate. So, you know, if that's the case, it's not working. What are the other ways that you can look at a service provider or a suite of services that takes care of, you know, that compromised wellbeing, that sort of tertiary injury management, but also that takes care of the performance enhancement, noting that, you know, if we look more at the EAP data, there's anywhere from sort of leader above in most organisations will not use an EAP. So, you know, to me, that again, that highlights that these people that are in more stressful roles that have greater job demands, if they're not using the EAP, then there's something wrong with the system, because they're the ones that are supposed to be modelling the behaviours that we want to see in our employees. So if they're not using the system, are others going to? So I would say do away with what an EAP is, what they're trying to be, and look at what is required for your environment. You know, great articles. Recently, there was some chat on LinkedIn about, you know, what is best practice from a critical incident response perspective. And, you know, the models that were traditionally used have potentially shown to be able to do more harm than they do good. So if that's the case, and that's why we have an EAP to respond to a critical incident, if that can be provided through other means, then that makes it less necessary. You know, what are the services that we need to develop that meets the needs of the organisation and the people within the organisation, that isn't, you know, that bucks the trend of, well, we'll just do it this way because it's the way we've always done.
It almost sounds like you're saying that organisations shouldn't just be trying to tick a box.
That's a very a much easier way to say what I was trying to say. Yes.
Dave, been a fascinating discussion with you today. One of the questions we ask all of our guests, though, is what are your hopes for the future of workplace mental health?
Oh, yeah. I would love to see an environment where, and we're seeing a little bit at a consumer level, people engaging with professional support to, you know, enhance their you know, their mental health. They're not waiting till there's a crisis. You know, we've got an offering that talks about performance services and, you know, targeted support to improve certain aspects of or certain areas that you want to work on. You know, for me, it's looking at organizations and employees within the organization at all levels engaging in these support services to enhance their performance and protect them against periods of illness and ill health, noting we all experience them. You know, that's my hope. What does that look like from a systems perspective? Well, it means that we've got to make sure that we're addressing or managing the workplace risks or the psychosocial factors that may be, that may affect injury and illness. But at the same time, there's this little quote that comes from some sports psychologist from the 70s, I think, that talks about using psychology for good. And for mine, it's looking at the systems that we have to be truly protective and about enhancing mental health whilst protecting against mental ill health and illness. That's my hope.
Yeah, and definitely speaks to our goals as well around preventing harm, but also promoting the positive. So, like you say, it's not a dichotomy, mental illness versus mental health. It's like it's a continuum, and we need to be providing a range of services. And not just thinking about trying to ameliorate mental illness, but what are we doing to help people to flourish?
And we know the stats. Almost half the population will experience symptoms consistent with a mental illness diagnosis at some point in their lives. So it's actually quite normal. So what are we doing to focus on the other aspects? It makes work more enjoyable, more productive, a better place to be. For mine, that's my hope for our industry and for, what workplace mental health should be.
Yeah, terrific.
So, Dave, do you have any words of advice for professionals who are thinking about working in the field of psychological health and safety?
Do it. There's so many avenues that you can probably go down. I would say that
going down a draftsman route first is probably not the most common route.
Look, if you want to, you can.
But, all paths lead to Rome, as they say.
Yeah.
All roads.
I think if it's an interest of yours, spend a little bit of time doing some study that aligns with where you see yourself working in the industry. If you continually enjoy it, then chase it down. The one thing that I guess I've learned about psychology is it's a very diverse field. And if we look at psychological health and safety, and the opportunities for growth and diversion, if you like, over the over the next decade or so, there's plenty of cool things to be doing. Just make sure you've got the evidence-based grounding to allow you to be successful.
Fantastic advice. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, well, again, Dave, it's been fantastic having you on today. It's definitely something, it's a new topic we haven't
talked about EAP before, so yeah.
Yeah. And, being able to hear it from someone like yourself who understands both sides of the coin, the psychosocial as well as the EAP side, has been probably the best way to discuss the topic. So thank you very much.
Certainly from our perspective.
Yeah, from our perspective, On a different podcast, it might fit in well. But, it's been terrific. So thank you very much for your time today, Dave.
Yeah, look, it's a pleasure. Lovely to talk with you both. And, I love the work that you're doing and I look forward to working with you guys further in the future.
Terrific. And for those listeners who are interested in finding out more about your work that you do at Mantle, how can people find out more?
Yeah, look, connect with me on LinkedIn. That's one way. You can check our websites out, mantlehealth.com.au. And don't hesitate on there. There's contact details for myself. Don't hesitate to drop us a line if you see the need.
Fantastic. Well, Dave, thanks again. And listeners, that brings us to the end of today's episode. So don't forget, we do record these things over the Zoom calls when we record the podcast. So feel free to check out the video if you like. And Dave's glorious mo that I've heard is now a permanent fixture on his face. So check out the video on the FlourishDX YouTube page. We will also drop a few clips on the FlourishDX LinkedIn page from this episode if you want to check out some of the highlights from today. While you're over on LinkedIn, as Dave said, he's there, so feel free to connect with him and connect with myself and Joelle if you'd like to continue the conversation there. But that brings us to the end of today. We'll catch you next episode.
You've been listening to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention, follow FlourishDX on LinkedIn and subscribe to the Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.psychhealthandsafety.com.